Hello, this is Sandra Ferguson with the Friday, December 7th, 2018 edition of the News Gazette. And we will begin on the front page with a piece about the search for Yingying Zheng called Christensen Trial Moving to Peoria. Judge, convenience for court outweighs inconvenience for alleged victim's family, by Ben Zigerman. Brent Christensen will be tried for the kidnapping and killing of Yingying Zheng, 90 miles from where the alleged crimes occurred. This week, Peoria-based U.S. District Court Judge James Shadid approved Christensen's attorney's two-month-old request for a change of venue from Urbana to Peoria, but not because of the significant pretrial coverage the case has received locally, as the defense cited in its motion. Even if the court were to find a complete absence of prejudicial pretrial publicity, an unlikely finding given the significant public interest in this case, the court's balancing of the Rule 18 trial venue factors would still weigh in favor of transfer to the Peoria Division, Shadid wrote. Christensen is accused of kidnapping Ms. Zheng, a visiting University of Illinois scholar from China, last seen entering his car June 9, 2017. Christensen said he dropped her off a few blocks away. He was arrested on his birthday, June 30, 2017, on a kidnapping charge. 13 weeks later, a federal grand jury indicted him on additional charges of kidnapping, resulting in death and lying to the FBI. Shadid said he considered the convenience of defendant, witnesses, and the victim's family. In addition, the court has considered docket management, courthouse space, and the prompt administration of justice. Shadid took over this case in August after Judge Colin Bruce was removed from hearing criminal cases following the public revelation of emails between him and a paralegal for the U.S. Attorney's Office. Shadid, who's now overseeing criminal cases in Peoria and Urbana, said having the trial in Peoria where he sits would allow him to manage his cases there more easily. A Peoria trial setting will allow the undersigned to attend to other civil and criminal matters before, during, and after the court adjourns for the day, whereas an Urbana trial setting would require the undersigned to reschedule hearings in other cases that would otherwise be addressed during breaks in this trial, Shadid wrote. Given the anticipated length of this trial and the other matters currently pending before the undersigned, concerns of docket management thus weigh heavily in favor of transferring this matter to the Peoria Division. The trial, scheduled for April 2019, is expected to last at least 5 weeks. Genuine concerns. Prosecutors had objected to a change of venue, including a plea from Ms. Zhang's family to keep the case in Urbana, as they said they've developed strong ties with the community. Urbana attorney Steve Beckett, who represents Ms. Zhang's family, was disappointed for the family by the news of a move. There are genuine concerns for the Zhang family, who felt welcomed and supported by the University of Illinois community, Beckett said. While a move to Peoria and away from Urbana may be legally appropriate, it does raise the emotional stakes for the family. Shadid said he strongly considered the family's wishes. The factor which weighs most heavily against transfer of this case to the Peoria Division is the fact that the victim's family will likely be somewhat inconvenienced, Shadid wrote. However, he said the other factors outweighed this, writing that the court believes the timely ruling on this issue 5 months ahead of the scheduled trial will allow the United States to assist the victim's family in developing support and ties to the Peoria community as well. Peoria's pluses. He also said the move to Peoria shouldn't be a major inconvenience for witnesses, as most of them are law enforcement officers who regularly travel throughout the district as part of their law enforcement duties. He noted that the Peoria courthouse is only an hour and a half drive from the Urbana courthouse. Shadid also cited the significantly greater parking accommodations at the Peoria courthouse and the number of jury trials already scheduled for April at the smaller courthouse in Urbana. The availability of additional courtrooms in the Peoria division would allow this matter to be tried without significantly inconveniencing the other judges or delaying other trial settings, he wrote. Moreover, the increased size of the Peoria courthouse and significantly greater parking accommodations are particularly beneficial in this case, where the parties anticipate summoning a large pool of potential jurors. There are roughly 1,500 parking spaces in three parking decks near the Peoria courthouse, Shadid said, and about 180 in the municipal parking lot near the Urbana courthouse. And the next piece is about the NCAA volleyball tournament, The Place to Be. Sweet 16, Illini versus Marquette, 11 a.m. today. Huff Hall on center stage. It kind of reminds me of an old school gym. By Anthony Zillis, Champaign. The excuse notes have been written. The pleas have been issued to students and the public. The preparations have been made with regards to parking and the on-campus traffic of cars and bodies midday on a Friday. Now it's time to see how the Illinois volleyball team's strange 11 a.m. weekday start time for its Sweet 16 match against Marquette works out. Ticket sales are still doing really well, Illinois Associate Athletic Director Holly Stalkup said on Thursday. I think coach and the team and a lot of marketing has really pushed, take a long lunch, get an excuse note. I think our community is really behind this team and behind hosting this event. Even though it might be an 11 a.m., you should expect a great crowd still. The unique start time won't go unnoticed on campus. The College of Applied Health Sciences will move some of its classes to other venues to accommodate post-match press conferences and other needs, and parking spots will be occupied by various personnel, including a large ESPN TV truck that will broadcast the game. While it provides certain challenges, ESPN producer Trevor Towell sees the tournament's opening time slot in a positive light. That's kind of nice to be the site to kick all of the coverage off and get everyone excited for volleyball, he said. The location of the iconic arena on 4th and Gregory Streets adds to the headaches, including parking. The age of Huff Hall also makes certain things difficult, like setting up cables for the ESPN crew. But the TV sight lines are great, according to ESPN director Jim Roller, and the arena itself is a boon to ESPN, which will air the game on ESPNU. Some of the bigger gyms that do college basketball and bigger events, it almost feels too big, and there are a lot of empty seats, Tal said. You're not going to have any empty seats in here. It's going to be loud and crazy. It kind of reminds me of an old school gym. It's really got a nice feeling to it. The acoustics are good. I've done both sides, and I honestly prefer a smaller gym, where you don't see a lot of empty seats and you feel like there's a good vibe in the building. That sentiment is shared by Janine Ullman, Ohio State's Deputy Athletic Director, who is also a representative from the NCAA Women's Volleyball Committee. Old arenas like Huff Hall are a dying breed, after all. I just think you're at a place that appreciates volleyball, so it'll be fun, Ullman said. I think for the teams that are here, it provides them a really good experience. The crowd is kind of right on top of them here. While it may be a suitable regional site, don't expect Huff Hall or Illinois to host a Final Four anytime soon. It doesn't come close to meeting the capacity requirements, among other stipulations. But for a few hours today and Saturday, Champaign will be the center of the college volleyball world. The Wisconsin and Illinois bands will fill the arena with sound, as will the members of the student section, if they can get out of class, that is. And next, a piece about Interstate 74 accident. Maroons pray for other team after fatal crash. Bus driver critical, coach needs surgery, players okay. By Lindsay Jones. Champagne. Going forward, they'll pray. After a bus carrying the Normal West High School freshman girls basketball team they'd just played hours earlier was involved in a horrific crash that left two people dead Wednesday night, a handful of Champaign Central Maroon players discussed praying for their opponents and for their safety before they traveled for games. "Every player I've talked to is in disbelief," Central coach Level Mabel said Thursday. A couple of them mentioned getting together and having positive conversations and praying for their own safety. Many questions about what led to Wednesday night's crash remained unanswered Thursday when the Maroons took the court for a game against crosstown rival Centennial and the Normal West community, mourned Charles Crabtree, the 72-year-old school volunteer and bus passenger who died in the head-on collision. Also killed, the driver of the semi-truck that police say was headed in the wrong direction on Interstate 74 when it collided with the bus carrying Normal West 8 players, Mr. Crabtree, Coach Steve Price, and the team driver. The Peoria County Coroner's Office identified the driver of the semi as Ryan Hute of Del Mar, Iowa, but authorities did not offer any explanation Thursday for why he was traveling eastbound in the westbound lanes when the collision occurred at mile marker 137 near Downs. The conditions of the 10 surviving members of the Normal West traveling party varied. The driver of the team bus, who has not been identified, remained in critical but stable condition Thursday afternoon at OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria, officials said. The coach, one of the three adults airlifted from the crash scene, was on the road to recovery, Unit 5 officials said. Price suffered broken bones and will require surgery. All 8 players were treated for injuries and released without being admitted. 4 from OSF St. Joseph Medical Center in Bloomington, 4 from Advocate Broman Medical Center in Normal. Late Thursday afternoon, Normal West thanked community members and well-wishers for their support during a difficult time. "We are so sad to see the passing of a great Wildcat volunteer, Charlie Crabtree," the district wrote in Facebook post. "Charlie had a special way of connecting to every student he met. This is a great loss for our school." All students have been released from the hospital and are recovering from the accident. Although Coach Price has many broken bones, he is on the path to recovery as well. Please continue to send positive thoughts. And next, from the University of Illinois, due process suit settled, student to be readmitted, by Ben Zigderman, Urbana. A student dismissed from the University of Illinois for an alleged sexual assault has settled his federal lawsuit with the university. The student, identified only as John Doe, lost his case in July, but later appealed it. He was originally dismissed in April 2017 for 2.5 years, with the possibility of readmission after that. Under the settlement, Doe was able this fall to petition for readmission in next year's summer or fall terms, about 2.5 years after he was dismissed. If accepted, Doe agreed to dismiss his appeal, the settlement said, a copy of which was obtained by the News Gazette through an open records request. He apparently was readmitted as the appeal was dismissed, though UI spokeswoman Robin Kaler declined to confirm or deny that due to federal regulations. The university also agreed that if Doe was readmitted, it would remove the dismissal notation from Doe's transcript to maintain other discipline and dismissal records according to standard protocol, and to not describe Doe's time away from enrollment as voluntary if asked. Doe will need to retake classes he was in when he was dismissed. Both sides agreed not to discuss the settlement, and Doe's lawyers, Chicago-based Mark Roth and Bob Fioretti, did not respond to emails seeking comment. Doe, a sophomore at the time of the incident, allegedly sexually assaulted Jane Roe, then a senior, in the early morning hours of December 4, 2016. And again, Jane Roe is in quotation marks. After an investigation, a review panel concluded that after a night of drinking, he convinced Roe's friend that he could take Roe home, took her instead back to his apartment, and had sex with her. Roe told investigators that she repeatedly told Doe no, and that she does not do hookups. After being dismissed, Doe filed a federal lawsuit criticizing the UI's process for handling sexual assault cases, arguing that his due process rights had been violated. In addition to arguing that the sex was consensual, Doe's lawyers took issue with the UI's process for investigating sexual assaults, arguing that he was only interviewed once, several weeks after the alleged assault, wasn't allowed to review the final investigative report, and wasn't allowed to attend a hearing to present his side of the case and cross-examine witnesses. In the UI's process, an investigator interviews both parties, who can give supporting information and identify witnesses. The investigator then compiles a report that both parties can review and submit a response to. Then the investigator compiles a revised report, which both parties can also submit responses to. The final investigative report is then submitted to a three-person panel, which meets with and questions the investigator. The panel then makes a decision by a simple majority vote using the preponderance of the evidence standard of proof. In July, U.S. District Court Judge Colin Bruce ruled in the UI's favor, but urged it to change how it investigates sexual assault claims. Bruce said Doe wasn't entitled to due process in this case because he didn't prove that he suffered a tangible loss after being dismissed. But he criticized the UI's investigative process. While the UI doesn't need to implement a full-blown criminal trial with counsel, the right to cross-examine witnesses, or the reasonable doubt standard, he said, that at the very minimum, an accused party should be able to present his or her case to the person or people who actually decide their fate. Kaler said the settlement doesn't mean the UI thought it would lose during the appeal. The university often works to amicably resolve legal matters and avoid potential litigation, even if the university is confident it would prevail if further litigation was pursued, she said. This due process lawsuit was one of several filed since 2011, when the U.S. Education Department issued its Dear Colleague letter that said colleges should use a preponderance of the evidence standard in sexual assault cases. Last year, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos rescinded the letter, allowing colleges to use the higher, clear, and convincing evidence standard. And we'll turn now to the opinions page and begin with an editorial called Cash for Christmas. Producers may not be happy about it, but consumers love falling oil prices. Timing, as the saying goes, is everything. So the decline in gasoline prices, just as Christmas is around the corner, could not be better news for consumers who appreciate having more money in their pockets. This week, the gasoline prices in Champaign-Urbana fell to about $2 a gallon for unleaded. Just a few months ago, the price for the same gallon of gasoline was closing in on $3. Back in May, the international price for a barrel of oil was around $75. Now it's around $60 a barrel, a decline that has prompted Middle East oil producers to try to drive up prices by cutting production. But the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, no longer has the clout to set the world price of oil. For that, Americans can thank the U.S. oil industry, most particularly those who conceived two powerful new means of production, fracking and horizontal drilling. These new drilling methods, coming on top of new oil discoveries in this country, have propelled the U.S. back to its one-time status as the world's largest producer of crude oil. Indeed, U.S. oil output has more than doubled over the past decade. The dramatic step forward is another vindication of what the late University of Illinois economist Julian Simon called the ultimate resource. He was referring to solving problems by thinking our way through them. "Never bet against the U.S. industry," said energy consultant Bob McNally in tribute to the brain power that has driven oil production, or, for that matter, other industries here and abroad. Declining oil prices don't just provide an economic boost to individuals and business that must buy fuel. They also have a big impact on geopolitics. For example, Russia is a major oil producer. But it's not the only major oil producer, and that limits its ability to influence other countries' foreign policy decisions by threatening to reduce or cut off oil supplies. That goes double in the Middle East, where countries like Saudi Arabia have used their vast oil supplies to enrich themselves and obtain privileged diplomatic status. Those countries aren't happy about the status quo, and they are looking to do something about it. OPEC countries met this week in the hope of agreeing on a production cut of about 1 million barrels a day that would drive prices back up. Agreement was delayed on the issue because OPEC needs time to try to persuade Russia to join in the production cut. Not every country, however, wants to cut production because that means less oil to sell and less revenue. Further, it's unclear if even a production cut of 1 million barrels a day would have a dramatic impact on current prices. One analyst suggested it would take a production cut of 1.4 million barrels a day to get prices back where OPEC wants them. One thing, however, is for sure. Prices eventually will rise and then fall again. In a market that's based on supply and demand, prices fluctuate. Right now, they're down, providing a cash bonus for people who can use the money they would have spent on fuel on other things. And we'll look now at the From Our Readers section and begin with a piece written by C.G. Estabrook from Champaign called Trump's Critics Have It Backwards. The New York Times published the following: "Trump is unique as a magnet for grifters, climbers, and self-promoters, in part because decent people won't associate with him. With the exception of national security professionals sticking around to stop Trump from blowing up the world, there are two kinds of people in the president's orbit, the immoral and the amoral." This is backwards. The neocons are desperate to prevent Donald Trump's carrying out his campaign proposals for rapprochement with Russia and China, and withdrawal from Barack Obama's wars and war provocations from Ukraine to the South China Sea. Since the Open Door Policy, 1899, the U.S. government has continually used war and war provocations to constrain the economic integration of Eurasia, which would limit the ability of the U.S. 1% to exploit it. State Department official George Kennan wrote in 1945, "We have about 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which will permit us to maintain this position of disparity without positive detriments to our national security. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. Since 1945, the U.S. has killed more than 20 million people in wars, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, and elsewhere, designed to maintain the disparity. The Times decent people are determined today to see that Trump doesn't abandon that policy. Again, that was written by C.G. Estabrook of Champaign. The next piece is written by Lance Dixon of Champaign, called Right to Vote, Not Subject to Dispute. There's been a lot of grumbling about students voting in local elections. More specifically, grumbling about students voting for Democrats and ruining the fun for local Republicans. Okay, let's think this through. I moved to Champaign from the Chicago area to attend the University of Illinois in 1987. I'm still here, 31 years later. At what point would mighty local townfolk bestow upon me my right to vote here? My fifth year in Champaign? My 10th year? Is it even okay for me to vote today? I didn't go to middle school with any of the candidates, so I don't really know them. Please enlighten me, my GOP friends. There's this thing called the internet with which younger people are very proficient. They use it to find local restaurants, pay their rent, and even research political candidates. What a concept! Everyone knows that the Republican Party does better when fewer people vote. But please give me a break with this nonsense. Those who reside legally in Champaign County have a right to vote here. What's been lost in this silly discussion is that some great candidates won. I've met most of them, and they are good, smart people who will work hard at their new jobs. So congrats to them, and kudos to those students who stood in line for 2 hours on Election Day to exercise their right to vote. And that again was written by Lance Dixon of Champaign. The next piece was written by Renee Mullen of Champaign, called Let's Pray to Lift Pitt's Blindness. Columnist Leonard Pitts hypocritically uses any excuse to find fault with President Donald Trump and conservatives. He consistently writes that liberals have the moral high ground and how morality matters. His latest excuse for finding fault concerns thousands of Central Americans attempting to gain entry to the U.S., including those who illegally stormed the border and assaulted patrol agents. Under former President Barack Obama, the same tactics were used to prevent illegals entry and enforce laws. But Pitts accepted them under Obama. Perhaps Pitts and his followers could channel their energy into changing immigration laws they feel are unjust, rather than encouraging breaking existing laws. This is what pro-life supporters are doing. We are working peacefully, lawfully, to change what we know is an unjust law, legal abortion, that allows the chemical burning and dismemberment of thousands of unborn children a day. Pitt's followers call the current administration's actions a new low, cruel and cowardly and monstrous. Yet chemical burning and dismemberment of children is not a new low, cruel and cowardly or monstrous. Pitts argues his disagreement with President Trump are about our national soul, but killing 3,000 children daily, unborn babies who suffer the pain of abortion, isn't relevant to our national soul? For those who recognize the truth about abortion, let us double down in our prayers for Pitts and his followers that their spiritual blindness may be lifted so they may finally acknowledge the truth about abortion. And that again was written by Renee Mullen of Champaign. And we'll take a short break now and then return with the second half hour of the Friday, December 7th, 2018 edition of the News Gazette. I'm Sandra Ferguson. Please stay tuned.